Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jim Doyle. We're going to be starting the call in about a minute. Thanks a lot. Thank you for joining today's conference call. I'm Jim Doyle with Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. Now that the U.S. and Senate and House have passed their own tax bills, a conference committee will be reconciling differences before each chamber votes again, likely as soon as next week. Join us today to discuss the two bills, a possible compromise, and what happens to them next week. Is Mark Mazur. Mark is the Robert C. Posen Director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, a joint venture of the Urban Institute and Brookings Institution. He served in the federal government for 27 years in various positions, most recently as Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy at the Treasury Department. This is an interactive phone briefing, so after Mark's remarks, we'll open up to you for questions. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 business leaders across America. At these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives get the chance to brief policymakers on issues affecting their businesses and how Washington can work with business to accelerate our economy. Today, more than 600 mayors, governors, members of Congress, and senior administration officials have participated in our programming. This is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I'd like to cover a couple housekeeping items. First, this call is on the record. There may be reporters present. This also means that we will release a recording later today. Second, this is an interactive phone briefing, and there will be time for you to ask questions and share your advice. You can do this in one of two ways. You can press 1 at any time to ask your question live. Or you can email that question to us at info@businessfwd.org. When we call on you to ask a live question, please introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. Please include that same information if you email us a question. Again, you can press 1 to ask your question live or send your question via email to info@businessfwd.org, and we'll add it to the queue. Let's get started. Please welcome Mark Mazur of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Mark.
Oh, great. Thanks, Jim, for having me here today. It's good to be with you all. What I want to do is spend a couple minutes just going through the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act as passed by the House and by the Senate, try to highlight some of the important provisions of the bills, talk a little bit about some of the analyses that we have done at the Tax Policy Center on these bills, and then leave time for questions from you all. So, a version of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed by the House in early November, and another version was passed by the Senate in early December. Both of these bills do big things. The House bill, which is where I'll start, restructures the way multinational firms are taxed, moving toward a territorial system where the U.S. would generally impose no tax on the real profits of real foreign subsidiaries operating in countries with real tax systems. It substantially lowers the corporate tax rate from 35% today to 20%. It would establish a new tax regime for income earned by pass-through entities, allowing for a preferential tax rate for income from those types of entities. It would substantially increase the standard deduction on the individual income tax and repeal personal exemptions for individual income taxpayers. It would increase the child tax credit and introduce a new family tax credit for non-child dependents and for spouses and taxpayers. It would lower income tax rates and repeal the alternative minimum tax, would repeal a number of itemized deductions, though would maintain an itemized deduction for mortgage interest and charity. It would increase the exemption amount for the estate tax and eventually repeal the estate tax. On the business side, the House bill would allow businesses to expense new capital investments for 5 years, sort of like bonus depreciation on steroids. It would make some real tax reforms. It would consolidate education credits. It would repeal the use of private activity bonds. It would make dozens of smaller changes in the tax law, repealing relatively small tax benefits, though many of these benefits have very vocal constituencies. And the House bill would change the inflation index used to adjust individual income tax parameters for inflation from the Consumer Price Index for Urban Consumers, or CPIU, which is used today, to what is called the chain CPI. And economists tend to think of chain CPI as a better measure of inflation, better measure of changes in the cost of living. But importantly, it tends to grow slower than the CPI we're all used to hearing about and what we have used. And so what that means is that change by itself will reduce the value of a number of tax parameters, and so increase taxes compared to current law for a lot of taxpayers. Okay, taken together, when we analyze the House legislation, we find that it loses about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years and a similar or larger amount over the subsequent 10 years. It makes the tax system a bit less progressive. In the near future, provides tax cuts to most income groups, but with larger tax cuts to higher income individuals. And in the later years, some provisions expire, but other changes like the new inflation adjustment keep acting to increase individual income tax liabilities. So we estimate by 2027, about 25% of households under the House bill would pay more tax than they do under current law. When Tax Policy Center examined what the House bill would mean for the overall U.S. economy, we found it would have a modest positive effect in the short term due to two things. One, increased demand from consumers and businesses due to tax cuts. And two, increased investment in capital equipment by businesses due to the temporary expensing provisions. But importantly, these factors would wear off over time as increased federal budget deficits would lead to higher interest rates and consequently lower investments in the future. And overall, we estimate that these macroeconomic effects would offset about one-tenth of the cost of the tax cuts over the 10-year budget window. Now let me turn to the Senate bill. The Senate bill shares a lot of features with the House bill. It has a similarly large reduction in the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%. Though it would start that reduction in 2019 instead of 2018. The Senate bill would change the way multinational firms are taxed in a qualitatively similar way to the House bill, but with different sets of detailed rules to prevent firms from trying to inappropriately shift income to lower tax jurisdictions. It would change the way pass-through entities are taxed by providing a deduction against income for income earned in these pass-through entities. So essentially provides a lower marginal effective tax rate on pass-through income for many taxpayers. It makes similar but not the same changes to the individual income tax, has a larger child credit, changes in the rates, repeals the alternative minimum tax. It increases the exemption amount of the estate tax but does not repeal it. And the Senate bill makes fewer miscellaneous reforms. I think the House bill, if you look at this as a tax reform exercise, the House bill contains a somewhat higher ratio of reform to tax cuts than the Senate bill does. And the Senate bill, because of the budget reconciliation rules, turns off most of the individual income tax provisions after 2025. So when we did an analysis of the Senate bill at the Tax Policy Center, we found that it would lose about $1.4 trillion over the 10-year budget window, but would not lose revenue outside the budget window, largely because the individual tax provisions were turned off after 2025. Overall, we think this would be a regressive tax cut that provides larger benefits to higher-income households on average. But the Senate bill is tilted a bit less in the near term to higher income households than the House bill. And the vast majority of taxpayers would experience a tax cut in the near term under the Senate bill, but as I mentioned, with the expiration of many of the provisions in 2025, nearly half of the households in the United States would see a tax increase by 2027. We also did a macroeconomic analysis of the bill that was passed by the Senate, and we estimated the effects to be, again, modest over the budget window, with the economy being a few tenths of a percentage point larger by the late 2020s. And we estimate that the Senate version of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act would generate enough macroeconomic activity to offset about one-sixth of the revenue cost, so a little bit more than the House bill. And right now, we're in the process of watching the conference committee try to come to an agreement, and I think we're hearing things all the time about close to an agreement, and here are some possible details. I think we'll have to wait and see exactly what the agreement looks like, and in particular, wait to see the legislative language that comes out to see how a lot of the very detailed provisions of the bills get ironed out. With that as introduction, I'd be happy to open it up to questions from the audience.
Thank you, Mark. If you have a question, please press 1 on your dial pad to be join the queue to ask your call live, or you can email your question to info@businessfwd.org. Please remember to introduce yourself with your business and where you're calling from. First question is from Judith Pina in Charlotte, North Carolina. Question is, your growth assumptions are lower than what the Treasury Department announced this week. Can you explain how they came to a different conclusion?
Sure. A couple things. One, the analysis that we did of the macroeconomic effects of this bill are quite similar to what the Joint Tax Committee found and similar to what the Penn Wharton budget model found in looking at the details of this particular bill and what the impact would likely be. I think what the Treasury Department released yesterday, or day before yesterday, their one-page paper on the growth and revenue effects based on the tax bill largely does not do a detailed analysis of the macroeconomic effects of this particular piece of tax legislation. Largely what it does is take the budget, the president's budget document, and look at the growth rates that were assumed in that budget document and then apply them to this analysis and say that, well, if we get the same growth that we projected in the budget as we expect because of these tax cuts, then they would largely pay for themselves. But this is not it's not analysis that you would want to subject to peer review. It's essentially a replay of what was in the president's budget, but is not focused on the details of the tax legislation under consideration, which is the type of analysis that we did and Penn Wharton budget model did and Joint Tax Committee did. And all of those three organizations found that the tax cuts would pay for a small fraction of the total cost through economic activity, maybe one-third, I think, by the estimates of the Joint Tax Committee, and one-sixth or so by ours and Penn Wharton budget model.
Next question is live. It's Charles Moore from Lansing, Michigan. Charles?
Yes, can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Yes, I can.
Okay, the question I had is, in your discussion, you have a broad array of tax cuts, and one of the things that hasn't been talked about much is where do we raise revenue at? Is it only from projected growth in the economy from the tax cuts that creates the revenue offset?
Okay. Thanks for the question, Charles. And I'm wondering if you guys are getting snow there yet. My daughter goes to Michigan State, and she's finishing up finals, and I'm wondering if she's going to be snowed on to do that.
You're sitting in here with one of my staff people. He's a student at Michigan State, too, and we have about 4 or 5 inches here.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, it's more snow than we have in Washington, and I guess go green to you guys. Okay. Where's the revenue raised come from? Both the Senate and the House bill have gross somewhere around $4 trillion of tax cuts and net somewhere around $1.5 trillion of tax cuts. So there's about $2.5 trillion of revenue that gets raised in each of these bills. And it comes in a variety of ways. In the on the individual income tax side, both bills increase the standard deduction a lot but repeal personal exemptions. And those are largely offset each other in that sense that the amount of revenue you lose by one is kind of offset to a large extent by the other. So repealing personal exemptions is one of the major revenue raisers. In addition, the House bill would repeal a number of itemized deductions, like for medical expenses and the state and local income and sales tax deduction, and have a number of other smaller reforms to take items that are excluded from income today, so some types of employee benefits or education benefits provided by employers or tuition waivers for graduate students, and those would all be repealed under the House bill as revenue raises. On the business side, the domestic activities production deduction would be repealed. The Section 199 deduction would be repealed as one of the revenue raisers on the business side. And there would also be a limitation put on deductions for interest paid by businesses. So there's a lot of pluses and minuses that are going on here. I think on net, both are relatively large tax cuts, but it is important to note that the details matter a lot. And so if you look at individual situations, depending on your family size, family structure, sources of income, amount of income, you could see a tax cut or a tax increase, though most households will get tax cuts in the short term. And on the business side, same thing, depending on where what your business activities are, what tax benefits you claim under current law, and what the pluses and minuses are going to be under these proposals, you could see a tax cut or a tax increase, though most businesses would get a tax cut under these bills.
Our next question is from Max Trujillo from Maryland. Max, you're on the line.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to ask you if you have more information on how the CFCs, the Controlled Foreign Corporations, are going to be treated. I know that the House and the Senate versions were not in the same line, although apparently the Senate version may be having a bigger chance of becoming the conference language. I want to get your sense if there has been any analysis of the impact of the CFCs that are right now operational in the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and its financial impact if no protective language is taken there to protect those companies. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Max. So we have not done any specific analysis related to CFCs, Controlled Foreign Corporations, in Puerto Rico. So I really can't answer that specific question. But the one thing that you highlight here that is really important is paying attention to the details as they get resolved. Both the House and the Senate have different approaches for taxing multinational firms, and whether you're on kind of the or how an individual's firm situation will be treated under the law will really depend on those details. And so that is really a place where I'd urge business owners and their tax advisors to pay a lot of attention to the details as they get resolved, because many of these things are going to be applicable starting January 1st, 2018. And so there's not like a ton of time to understand what the implications are and if necessary to adjust operations to accommodate the new tax law.
Our next question is by email. It's from Hollis Selway in Denver, Colorado. Her business runs a youth apprenticeship program question is, what are the implications of the new tax bills for revenue spent by corporations on training, for example, training of apprentices? Does this become a new liability for businesses or students?
I'm going to take a bit of a pass on the detailed question because it really will depend on how the program is structured. Under the House bill, employer-provided education would count as taxable compensation, but these include this typically includes things like education at colleges, universities, and potentially community colleges. In-house programs tend not to be treated the same way. The Senate bill has no programs like that. So again, this is one where the details of the way the conference committee resolves this are going to matter. I think from a tax policy standpoint, you want to ensure that because of an income tax, that the costs of generating income by the business would be deductible. And if those costs involve training for employees to make them better at their jobs, that seems like that should be a deductible expense. But this is something where, businesses and their tax advisors are going to have to pay attention to the details as they get resolved in the conference committee.
Our next question is from David Dewberry from Dayton, Ohio. David, you're on the line.
Good afternoon. Thank you. The proposed tax reforms that's being proposed right now, of course, they cut potential taxes, but they also could cut spending of programs. Could you address, under the statutory pay-as-you-go, the automatic spending cuts that Congress would make if the bill was enacted, and what programs it would affect, and to what extent?
Sure. So what David's referring to is, under current law, the Congress has passed a pay-as-you-go provision called PAYGO, which says if in any year the budget deficit is added to, there are automatic spending cuts that take place across a range of federal programs. I think they include things like food stamps and some small portion of Medicare and some other programs. Anyway, this has almost never gone into effect. Congress has always waived the effect of the automatic cuts under the PAYGO rules, I think maybe 15 times in the last several years. This is a bit of uncharted territory, what would happen here. If we have a tax bill that goes into effect where there's $100 billion plus of additions to the federal budget deficit in the current fiscal year, Congress will have to take a vote on whether to allow those cuts to go into effect or to waive them. And this will be a high-stakes political debate over how this gets addressed. I think allowing these cuts to go into place would be a fairly painful process where a number of individuals and programs who had counted on getting federal benefits going forward would suddenly see those reduced or eliminated. And so we'll have to see how Congress reacts when presented with that piece of legislation.
We've got a number of questions relating to education. There are two about costs for students. One is tax implications for college graduate students who receive tuition waivers. Another is tax implication for college students who take out loans. And then on the other side, we've got questions about 529 plans and what it could mean for K-12 education if people can use 529 plans for local schools. So we've got some questions about implications for students and then a larger question about local school districts. If you could take a crack at that, please.
Sure. So I'll do the first couple and then do the 529 programs later. So tuition waivers. Under the House bill, the exemption of income for graduate students for tuition waivers, so if a graduate student, say, is a research assistant or a teaching assistant and gets 10 credit hours, 12 credit hours of tuition paid for as a result of that, under the House bill, that would count as taxable compensation. And the graduate student would include that as income and pay tax on it. The Senate has no such provision. So this is one where the Conference Committee is going to have to work out what the implications are. But from the standpoint of a graduate student, under the House bill, it would be an unwelcome increase in their income tax payments beginning next year. The second question is on student loan interest. Under the House bill, the deduction for student loan interest would be repealed. And so, again, students who are incurring loans and expecting to claim the interest as a deduction would be unable to do so under the House bill. However, the Senate bill makes no changes in that regard. And so, again, this is one where the Conference Committee has to resolve the differences and determine a path forward. On the 529 programs, the question related to use of these, which are currently college savings programs, for private elementary and high schools, and this is an area where essentially uncharted territory. It's how this would work and how it would affect schools and both public and private schools. This is a provision that was added to the Senate bill, and again, we'll have to see what the Conference Committee does to resolve it. But my understanding is it would act very similar to the way the current 529 withdrawal rules work for colleges and universities, would extend it to elementary and secondary schools. But the details of that still need to be worked out, and that's something that the Conference Committee has to resolve.
Thanks. Another question is from Daryl Buchamp in Pella, Iowa. Related to the deficit projections, could I ask what baseline growth rate you are projecting without tax reform for your analysis? What I am hearing from customers and suppliers is that we should expect a reduction in current growth rate if tax reform does not pass. There may be incremental growth with tax reform, but we are more concerned about the potential macro effects if tax reform does not pass, with the compound effects of future legislation on infrastructure, et cetera, not having momentum to pass.
Right. So in our budget estimates at the Tax Policy Center, we use the Congressional Budget Office's estimates of economic growth going forward, which I don't have in front of me right now, but they tend to be around 2% growth in real gross domestic product GDP per year. Under the proposed tax legislation, we see that increasing in the short term to maybe by half a percentage point in the short term, but then leveling out fairly quickly. And so the overall level of gross domestic product at the end of the 10-year budget window under our projections is just a couple of tenths of a percentage point higher than the baseline. The questioner, though, also asked, well, what happens if this legislation doesn't get passed? Will markets and businesses and individuals be disappointed and disinclined to spend, and would there be a reduction in economic activity? I think the baseline that we're looking at assumes current law. So the 2% say growth rate assumes current law, and the 2% and a little growth rate would be with the tax cut bill passed. We don't see a big effect either way. It would be modest, either a modest plus effect or something like around the current level of economic activity.
And our last question, we've got a number of questions related to healthcare and the impact on Obamacare and what it could mean for coverage rates. Mm-hmm. Just to try to lump these together, how would the cost of increases in health insurance costs compared to the potential tax savings that a typical family, a middle-income family, might face?
Yeah, this is another very much an open issue that under the Senate bill, the individual mandate provisions under the Affordable Care Act would be essentially removed by reducing the penalty to zero. And what the Congressional Budget Office believes will happen is that this means fewer people will get coverage. Those who decline to get coverage will tend, on average, to be healthier. That will lead to a slight worsening of the risk pool, increasing health insurance costs for people who are still purchasing from that individual buyer pool. And so the question that you asked is, well, could some people be made worse off by getting a tax cut and having it eaten up in part or altogether by health insurance costs? And I think the answer is yes, but again, it's going to depend a lot on the situation of the individual. What their in terms of the tax cut, it's going to depend on their family size and composition and their sources of income and amounts of income. On the healthcare side, it will depend on their options for coverage, whether their employer provides it or whether they seek coverage on their own, and what the what portion of the premiums that the individual pays compared to the employer. So it's a hard one to figure out, but again, almost for sure there will be some people who will be made worse off as a result.
Thank you, Mark. We really appreciate that. That's all the time we have for today. Please check your email for a quick survey and recording of today's call. Thank you, Mark, for joining us. And we'll make sure that if anyone has questions, if you had questions and weren't able to get them asked, please send them to us, and we'll get them answered as quickly as we can for you. Mark, we really appreciate it, and everyone have a great day.